Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody.
Whoops. Three, there we go. Two.
Right. Welcome everybody, and welcome to Yaron Brooks Show on this beautiful Saturday. I hope you guys are having a good weekend. A few things I want to do today. Let me just get. As usual, YouTube is giving me problems. All right, there. That's much better. Okay, before we get to the main topic of today, which is basically the question of why Western civilization? Why has Western civilization been so successful? Why has there been this massive divergence in terms of quality of life, standard of living between Western civilization and the rest of the world? And we'll do that. We'll examine that question by looking at the answer to Niall Ferguson. Niall Ferguson, the British I think he lives now in the U.S. and I think is married to Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Niall Ferguson in 2011 wrote a book about Western civilization, in which I called Civilization, the West and the Rest, in which he provides his explanation, which is centered around six killer apps. He's trying to be hip, and he's trying to appeal to the tech. To the tech world with these killer apps, his six killer apps for prosperity, for civilization. So we're going to examine those, thanks to Libel Deutsch, who brought this to my attention and who asked a question on the Super Chat last time. And if you ask a good enough question on the Super Chat, I guess I turn it into an entire show. So that will be what we'll be talking about today. Before we do that, a couple of, some announcements. So, I'm not happy with the fact that of what Patreon did to Sargon Avakad, to Carl Benjamin, about a week ago, where they just dropped him. Here's a guy trying to make a living and using their platform to make a living. I absolutely think they have every right to do it, so I don't question their legal right to have a business relationship with whoever they want to have a business relationship with it. But I don't consider it good business, and I don't consider it the kind of action that somebody I deal with should engage in. So I think it's wrong. I think it's bad business practices, and I think there have to be consequences. I think some of those consequences I've already felt, because the number of people dropping support for me on Patreon has increased in the last week significantly. So that's obviously being felt. But I think I told you last time that I'm looking into some alternative platforms. Now, I think I've registered now on two alternative platforms, but it's going to take a while for them to, they have to vet it. They have to prove it or whatever. So you can keep an eye out if you're interested in switching platforms, or if you're interested in, for the first time, supporting the show. Subscribestar.com. Subscribestar.com is one platform that we're playing around with and are going to try to, I'll create a profile there, and you'll be able to subscribe. Now, you won't be able to, it looks like, use PayPal for that, because PayPal is not supporting Subscribestar, but you'll still be able to use a credit card, and you'll be able to use other means of payment. And you can set up a subscription service just like on Patreon. And the other one is LibraPay, LibraPay.com. I've set something up. The profile's not live yet. I'm not sure exactly how this one works. I think this one is more of a one-time payment kind of thing that you can do already on PayPal.me, Yaron Brooks Show. So for those of you who want an alternative to Patreon, it's here. As I see where you guys gravitate, and if people start shifting away from Patreon in significant ways, I might at some point shut down my Patreon account. But until I have a new one established, I'm not going to shut it down. So that's the news on that front. So hopefully sometime next week I'll have an update, although my assistant is on vacation for the next week. So I might not have I might not have news for you for another couple of weeks, but hopefully Subscribestar will be up and running in the next few days. The profile is up. There's something up there, and they're saying that it's waiting approval, waiting review or whatever. So hopefully that'll work. The second thing I wanted to let you know is that we are now selling products based on the Oren Brooks Show on Zazzle, I guess it's called, Z-A-Z-Z-E-L. And you can get T-shirts and you can get mugs with quotes from the Oren Brooks Show and the Oren Brooks Show logo. So if another way to support the show is go get a T-shirt. And if you do it today, tomorrow, you might be able to even get it before Christmas. So go buy a T-shirt. Hey, I'm trying to be a capitalist here and trying to get as much revenue as possible to make this show possible and make this show sustainable into the future. So two alternatives to Patreon, Subscribestar and Libra Pay. And they should be going live in the next few days. So stay tuned, I guess, on that. And of course, Zazzle will be selling mugs and T-shirts. All right. So what I want to talk about today, it's a huge topic. So, you know, we're going to kind of skim around, and I'm certainly no expert on this. But I think there's enough interesting things to say about it that it's worth doing a show about it. And, you know, Liberal Deutsch asked and he's not even on. I don't see him on the chat, so hopefully he'll join us. But he was the impetus for the show. He asked a couple of days ago about Niall Ferguson's six killer apps for Western civilization or for prosperity or whoever. I think it was six killer apps of prosperity was a TED talk that Niall Ferguson gave in 2011. Or 2012, based on his 2011 book called Civilization, the West and the Rest. And so what I did is I got the TED Talk and I watched the TED Talk, and it's excellent. I mean, Nigel Ferguson, if you don't know who he is, he's one of the leading, intellectuals in the world today, in the United States today. He's a Brit, but I think he lives in the U.S. He's married, I said, to Ayaan Hirsi Ali. He is a real historian. He's non-PC. He's a good writer. He's a good speaker. I've seen him speak a couple of times. And he's just he's a good intellectual. I don't agree with him on a lot of things. I'd say he's a conservative. I think he'd describe himself probably as a conservative. But he's smart. And he's brave, and he has interesting ideas. And I listened to his TED Talk, and I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was basically mostly true, and yet its problem was a problem of omission. It missed the big picture. It missed the point. It basically missed the most important integrations that have happened in history. So let's set this up, because we're going to go over his six killer apps, because I think they're interesting. And I think they're all true. I just don't think they're the killer apps that he thinks they are. I think they are subsidiary apps. They're sub-apps of the two real killer apps that make the six killer apps possible. So the six killer apps are consequences. They're not primaries, and he presents them as primaries, which is a shame. At least he does in a TED Talk. Now, maybe in the book he gets to greater depth, but I suspect not, because this is the kind of missing link between his views and our views is almost never bridged, because they can't quite get these two fundamental causes of the West's success. They cannot comprehend them, but we'll get to that. All right, so. What question is he trying to answer? And the basic question, he sets it up nicely in the TED Talk. The basic question is there. If you go back to 1500, there was almost no difference in terms of per capita income, quality of life, standard of living, life expectancy between a Brit and an Indian from India,
right?
Or between an American and a Chinese. Native American and a Chinese. Very little differences between any two groups in the world in terms of the material well-being of those people. Now, yes, you could argue that in certain parts of Europe, there was already an awakening and there was some increase of standard of living. But in spite of what many, revisionist historians would suggest, the Dark Ages were dark. Europe was poor. The dominant civilization during the Dark Ages was Islamic. The dominant empire all the way till the mid-17th century was the Ottoman Empire, not any European empires. The dominant civilizations were China, Ottoman, previous to that, the Mongolian. Europe was nothing special. Nothing interesting was going on in Europe. By 1500, you're already getting the Renaissance. But in terms of material quality of life, standard of living, nothing much has happened. And yet, if you flip forward to 1970s, the average Brit is more than 10 times richer than the average Indian, and the average American is 20 times richer than the average Chinese. And I think, to a large extent, a lot of that underestimates how much things got better in what we call the West. And the extent to which the average Indian and the average Chinese are wealthier than they used to be because of what happened in the West. That is the West's responsibility on a global scale for the improvement in standard of living across the entire world. It was the West that did it. It was the imitation, purely material, the ability to import cheap stuff, the ability to use science invented in the West, the ability to import medicines, the ability to import medical technology that was invented in the West. So whatever improvements had happened by the 1970s in places like India and China were mostly, not all, but mostly consequences of what had happened in the West between 1500 and the 1970s. And really, really, between 1750, or as I like to say, 1776, between somewhere around 1750 and 1970. Because that's where the massive increases in health and in wealth happen. And in health and in health and in wealth happen. And economic historians call this the Great Divergence. The Great Divergence. Basically, the rest of mankind stays at an income and wealth level that humanity had been for 100,000 years, since the beginning of mankind. And suddenly, in Western Europe and in the United States, wealth and health and longevity and quality of life and standard of living go through the roof, in a phenomena never seen in human history. Nothing comes even mildly close. It starts somewhere in the middle of the 18th century, and it takes off. And the question is, why? In many respects, by the end of the 18th century, end of the 17th century, China's in a better position to take off. It seems to be advancing faster. There seem to be technologies there that do not exist in the West. If anything, the West is importing things like the printing press. Well, gunpowder, printing press was, I guess, invented in the West, but you know, the technology existed in China before. Other technologies that existed in China well before they existed in the West. Islamic society, the Ottoman Empire was vast, rich, relatively speaking, for the era. There was still remnants from the Islamic golden age of some science going on. And yet, it wasn't not the Islamic world, certainly not the Islamic world, and not the Chinese, not Asia, not Africa, not anywhere. It was Western Europe and the United States. And the question is, what caused the great divergence? What led to this massive increase in wealth? And recently, there's been a lot of discussion about this. I think now Ferguson basically falls into a category of economic historians, and historians generally will call them the institutionalists, who believe that what makes the West different are the particular institutions that existed in Europe at that point in time. Institutions that are pro wealth creation, institutions that made it possible for that wealth to increase. And this is built on work done by a famous economist, Doug North, who is the great institutionalist, and who attributes a lot, and Niall, as we'll see when we go through the success, attribute a lot of the success of Europe to the existence of these institutions, which, you know, make it possible for wealth to be created, or provide incentives for wealth to be created. There are other schools, and particularly there's the work over the last few years of another economist by the name of Deirdre McCluskey, who I think is probably agrees more with, you know, my line of thinking, Ayn Rand's line of thinking, Leonard's line of thinking, but comes to completely different conclusions. But she views the role of ideas as primary, particularly moral ideals, but she gets the ideas wrong. And we can talk a little bit about that. We can talk a little bit about that, right? And then, of course, there's a variety of other explanations. There are the leftist explanations that have to do with, left explanations have to do with European empires, that have to do with exploitation, that have to do with natural resources, that have to do primarily, would have to do with slavery. All these materialistic reasons, economic materialism, Marxist kind of explanations of why the West was successful. And then you've got a variety of other kind of deterministic explanations. There's one, I guess, on the chat right now, testosterone. You know, testosterone levels were high in the West and they were low. So, I don't know. But again, a kind of deterministic biological explanation for why things happen where they happen when they happen. Right. So what I want to do is look at Niles and Al Ferguson's explanation, and then I'll try to integrate what he identifies, which is all, again, true, into what I think is a more robust explanation, a one more consistent with the idea that ideas shape the world, ideas drive the world. And then we can mention maybe what Deirdre's approach, we'll see. And then, of course, feel free to ask questions. Feel free to participate. You've got Super Chat, so use the Super Chat. We've done well with Super Chat the last few days, last week or so. Got some good, good revenue from the Super Chat, another source of revenue. Always looking for sources of revenue to make this happen. A few quotes that I think are interesting from now Ferguson's, TED Talk. You know, he talks about the fact that, Samuel Johnson, the great lexicographer, in a character in one of his novels published in 1759, asks, by what means are the Europeans thus powerful? Or why, since they can so easily visit Africa and Asia for trade or conquest, cannot the Asiatics and the Africans invade their coasts, plant colonies in their ports, and give laws to their natural princes? The same winds that carries them back would bring thus thither. I think that's how you say it, thither. Okay. So you know, people are asking themselves, even back then, and of course, maybe the people asking themselves the most this question, and I actually talked about this in the History of the Middle East course that I did, the people asking themselves the most this question were the Muslims, were the Ottomans. And Ibrahim Muteferrika, an Ottoman official, actually the man who introduced the printing press into the Ottoman Empire, he had a fight for that. It was very difficult. He asks in 1731 in a book, he asks, why do Christian nations, which were so weak in the past compared with Muslim nations, begin to dominate so many lands in modern times and even defeat the once victorious Ottoman armies? Now, what's fascinating is that Muteferrika, channeling the golden age of Islam, actually has an answer. And his answer is right. He has the right answer. And now Ferguson reprints, you know, he quotes his answer, but I don't think he fully understands, or at least he doesn't seem to fully integrate this answer with his apps. This is the answer. This Muslim, Ottoman, Ibrahim Muteferrika, he gives, quote, because they have laws and rules invented by reason. Because they have laws and rules invented by reason. Wow. 1731. And now we'll focus on the laws and rules when he should really be focusing on reason. So Ferguson concludes, and he presents some of the leftist critiques, and he says, look, geography isn't the cause. You can test this. You can put a wall between West Berlin and East Berlin and see what happens. Same people, same culture, same geography exactly, and yet big difference in result. It's not national character. It's not natural resources. We've done that test. It's none of these things. Then what is it? By the way, this is interesting. This is a quote he also quotes. This is a quote he provides from Adam Smith, 1776. Again, 1776. Adam Smith is writing about China. And Adam Smith writes, and this is in The Wealth of Nations, China seems to have been long stationary and probably long ago acquired that full complement of riches which is consistent with the nature of its laws and institutions. But this complement may be much inferior to what with other laws and institutions the nature of its soil, climate, and situation might admit of. Notice the theme here. The theme is, what's different are the laws and institutions. What's different in the West are the institutions that came up in the West that have made this great divergence possible. China's institutions keep it poor, keep it stagnant. The West institutions are making it rich. That's the difference, according to Adam Smith, and that's the difference, according to Niall Ferguson. And Niall presents six apps, he calls them. You can call them apps. You could call them institutions. You can call them phenomena, historical phenomena. But I think they're interesting, so it's worth talking about them. So here are the six, right? And we'll go over them one at a time. One is competition. Two is the scientific revolution. Three is property rights. Four is modern medicine. Five is the consumer society. And six is the work ethic. So competition, scientific revolution, property rights, modern medicine, consumer society, and the work ethic. Those are the six apps that, according to Niall Ferguson, make Western civilization, made it possible for the West to become so much richer than anybody else. It made it possible for that great diversion to happen. All right. And I would say all six of them are true. All six of them played a role. All six of them are interesting. But are they the fundamentals? Are they the driving force? Well, I doubt it. And we'll see whether we can integrate these six into one or into two, you know, maybe more significant, more fundamental principles, more fundamental mega apps. How about that? We'll have two at the end of this, two mega apps that explain the success of Western civilization and explain at least five of the six. You guys are going to have to help me with one of these. I'm not sure how to integrate it, but one of them could be just that accident of geography and an accident of history, and might not be integratable into my two mega apps. And the one that's harder for me to integrate, and again, maybe you will help me out with this, is the first one, and that is competition. What Ferguson is suggesting is that in Europe, because it's fragmented political system, and a separation already even in the 1500s between sovereigns and what you would call a modern corporation or business or a civil society. Not everything was run by the state. Not everything was controlled by the sovereign. Not everything was controlled even by the church. But there were secular institutions. You know, he gives the example of the City of London, which was a corporation that had existed in the 12th century. And it was competition among sovereignties. That is, think of the Italian city-states, the German city-states. Think of a country like France, which was in competition with a country like Spain, in competition with a country like England. So they were competitive political entities. But even within the competitive political entities, there was competition among civic entities that were not part of the government, whether it's guilds and others. He says nothing like this existed in China, for example. China was completely top-down. It was a monolithic state. It covered a fifth of all humanity. And if you had ambition, if you wanted to rise, if you wanted to be successful in life, there was a path. There was a path. Right? And the path was... The path was certain standardized tests. You would have to study in particular schools, go through certain tests, and be embraced, hired into one particular bureaucracy. One particular bureaucracy. Ooh, Greg suggests that what we have is an operating system and that these are apps that sit on the operating system. Oh, I like this. I'm going to steal this from Greg. That's nice. So it's one operating system. We still have to get to figure out how competition enters into this. But I think it does. I think we'll get to it, although the competitive nature is partially an accident of history and partially, particularly in its later forms, integrated by this operating system, which we'll get to. So I think that the political fragmentation, certainly the political fragmentation, is an accident of history. It's probably an accident of the fact that once the Roman Empire failed, nobody replaced them. It's an accident that the Ottomans weren't able to conquer Europe primarily in the 17th century. I mean, they were at the gates of Vienna. They had surrounded Vienna. What is it, 1652 or something like that, and were defeated. But you would have thought even in the decades earlier they could have overtaken Europe and subjugated Europe to the Ottoman Empire. I don't know enough about history to say that there's a causal reason. 1683, thank you, Radio Zelaza. 1683 was the siege of Vienna. That's when they were defeated. The siege preceded that. There were no empires in Europe that really placed everybody under one political authority. And there also is the fact that Christianity, with all of its flaws and all of its problems, and you know me, you know, about as anti-Christian as you'll find. The fact is that Christianity, that Jesus, because Christianity came out of political weakness, because of Christianity was born with political weakness, it was born a minority religious, an oppressed religion, a religion oppressed by an empire. Because of that, very early in Christianity was the idea of separating what is the churches and what is the states, the separation of state from politics in some sense. Jesus says, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and God what is God's, with the idea that there are two separate realms. There is an earthly realm and there is a godly realm, and in the earthly realm, Caesar rules. So you get already a separation, in a sense of competition, a separation of institutions, which is weaker during the Dark Ages, and that's why they're dark, but is looser as we get out of the Dark Ages, with more and more and more allowances for the earthly as compared to the godly. More and more allowed, you know, and of course, under the Protestants, that's even more so. I mean, Luther's attitude is, you know, all the stuff that you do in this world, I mean, I remember the example of usury because I wrote about that. Like charging usury. I mean, it's all sinful. It's all horrible. It's all just a manifestation of original sin. It's all a manifestation of the fact that life on earth is horrible and sinful and disgusting and awful and evil. In the kingdom of heaven, none of that exists. But you know what? We don't live in a kingdom of heaven, so go ahead. Who cares? Right? You'll suffer the consequences in the next life. Or if you're, you know, a lot of Protestants, Calvinists, were predetermined. So it's predetermined whether you'll go to heaven or hell, so what difference does it make? Right? There's a real, this aspect of predeterminism in Protestantism that basically says whatever, right? Because you already know, God already knows whether you're going to hell or to heaven. So what difference does it make? So there's an aspect of political accident. There's an aspect of the nature of Christianity and the separation of the godly and the material, the state and the church, which added to the fragmentation. There's, of course, the conflict within the church that created all kinds of conflicts. And Europe was just fragmented from Eastern Europe all the way to Western Europe. You see this massive fragmentation, which created real political competition and created pockets of ultimate freedom, pockets in which some of the things that Niall Ferguson talks about later on, scientific revolution, property rights, pockets in which that can happen, where it couldn't happen in other areas in Europe. But there are these pockets where there's freedom, right? There's pockets where there's respect for the mind and where this can flourish and then get exported out of the pockets and spread and impact the rest of the continent and ultimately America. So it is, you know, it is, I think, true that this competitive nature, this competition, this fragmentation, maybe another way to think about it is this, you know, relative freedom that the West started experiencing sometime from the Renaissance on, the authority of the church, the authority of Catholicism, the authority of the Pope, and ultimately the authority of the kings and the authority of the rulers slowly starts dissipating, slowly starts fragmenting, slowly starts disappearing. And people are more free. I think the competition is here, in a sense, a proxy for freedom, full-blown freedom. Not full-blown freedom from coercion, but freedom enough to think, freedom to experiment, freedom to come up with new ideas, freedom to try out new political systems. I mean, it is pretty amazing, and I'm kind of thinking on my feet here, but it is pretty amazing as I think of it, that in Europe you had these pockets like Florence of the 15th and 16th centuries, where you know the Medicis could sponsor these great works of art and philosophers, and the rediscovery of Greek sculpture and Greek writings and Greek plays, and create this island of civilization. And you know, and there were several of these little islands. But then later on, if you think about 18th, even 17th century, 18th century, Amsterdam and generally the Flemish lands and of that area, where there's relative political freedom and certainly intellectual freedom, so that Spinoza doesn't get killed and that you know scientists can write and people can escape to Amsterdam to explore new ideas. I mean, what would the West be if not for those places? So I think there's a lot to this idea of competition. I wouldn't call it competition, but certainly to this political fragmentation and to the ability of particular units to experiment, to try, and to attract people. So, I mean, the consequence of this fragmentation, let's also point out that the consequence of this fragmentation were also pretty brutal. That is, this was not just good, right? China, for the most part, lived in peace because, I mean, they'd have civil wars and then they would have this an empire established and they'd rule over every, you know, a fifth of mankind, and those fifth of mankind lived in relative peace. And violent deaths were, massive violent wars were unusual. I mean, there were periods in which they could, but then the empire was established and then they're gone. In Europe, what you have is constant warfare, constant bloodshed, constant killing because of this fragmentation, because of this multitude of political units, because of a multitude of ideological units. Think of the 100-year war, the 30-year war, and the many, many wars before that. So this fragmentation had a cost, and the cost was bloodshed. The cost was individual lives. Huge. And the cost is huge. It's not trivial. Okay, so that's competition, which, again, I'm going to boil down to, in a sense, freedom. Freedom. And primarily here, as we'll see, I think the issue is freedom of thought. The second one he brings up is the scientific revolution. And he says, look, there was no scientific revolution in the Oriental world. Well, yeah, they came up with some scientific ideas. They had science. But the whole thrust of the experimental method and using it on a grand scale for new discoveries and, you know, all this just didn't happen. There was a little bit of science here and a little bit of science there and some experiments here and experiments there and a little innovation here and a little innovation there, but there wasn't this mass of innovation going on all at once. There wasn't this massive experimentation and a whole attitude and a whole movement to study nature around us and then to turn that nature into something, into improving human life, into improving human life. There wasn't this grand scale attitude. Any other civilization, any other empire. Nobody else did this. From Newton to the people who applied Newton's ideas to mechanics, to machines, to he gives the example of ballistics, which helped them win wars because they were better at killing people, because you could tell where the bomb was going to drop, where the explosive was going to drop. There was no scientific revolution anywhere else. Now, at least in his TED talk, he doesn't try to tell us why this is. Is it connected somehow to the competition? Is it connected somehow to freedom? Or maybe it's connected to the killer app, the operating system that really drives Western civilization. Because where does the scientific revolution come from? Why does it happen when and where it happens? What are the ideas percolating through society at that point in time? Where are those ideas being discussed and debated and written about? Well, the scientific revolution comes out of the Renaissance. And the Renaissance is the discovery, is the rediscovery of Aristotle. It's the rediscovery of not just Aristotle, but the whole Greek approach to life. Whether it's Greek art, whether it's the idea of science, whether it's the whole Greek attitude as reflected in, you know, to me, as reflected in Michelangelo's David, that confidence, man on earth is able and competent and can do stuff and can go out there and execute. It's Aquinas who, a few hundred years earlier, had brought Aristotle firmly into the Catholic Church. I mean, Aristotle had been floating around the West for a while, but Aquinas put him firmly into the Western canon, into Western thought, and particularly in Italy. And so accident, the Renaissance happens in Italy, where people, for the first time, because of Aquinas, are using reason to evaluate the world. And then because of Aquinas, accepting the secular nature of the world, so that when they discover the Greeks, they don't reject them automatically. They embrace them. And what you get in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries is the rediscovery of the operating system. I mean, it was rediscovered maybe by Aquinas and those who followed him. But in those later centuries, its application is rediscovered. Its consistent application to every realm in life is discovered. Its philosophy manifests, the philosophical idea of reason, the philosophical idea of this is how we know the world, now applied to real issues, real problems of human survival, of human life, and human progress. And the scientific revolution is probably the most important of those manifestations. And it launches an era known as the Age of Reason. It launches an era known as the Enlightenment. You know, think about Newton, early 18th century, late 17th century, right? About the same time as John Locke, same part of the same revolution, the Age of Reason. So it is reason, the rediscovery of our capacity to understand the world, the validity of our senses, the validity of reality. Reality is what it is. A is A. And our ability to understand reality, integrate that knowledge, abstract, create abstractions, and better understand the world through those abstractions. That ability that is uniquely human, that is what the operating system that makes these apps possible. That's what makes the scientific revolution possible. And I would argue that that's what made meaningful competition possible. Because while he talks about competition, I mean, there's competition in Eastern Europe. There's competition in Africa. There's competition in parts of the Middle East where they weren't dominated completely by one empire. There were competition in India, I think. There were lots of little kingdoms. It's not the competition in and of itself. What the competition did is, or what the fragmentation did, the political fragmentation did, is it allowed, it let this rediscovery of reason flourish. It let the operating system work. It let people figure out the bugs. It let people experiment. And as a consequence, part of the consequence, you get the scientific revolution as one application. Another application, to go from Newton to Locke, is the third app, which now Ferguson talks about, which is property rights. And here he's trying to differentiate. He's trying to make clear that it's not democracy. And I agree with him completely. It's not democracy. It's what he calls having the rule of law based on private property rights. That's what makes the difference. That's what makes North America different than South America, Europe different than Asia, Europe different than the Middle East. The concept of property rights, the idea that your property was yours, is unique. He gives the example of North America and South America. He gives the example of that by 1900, most people in rural North America owned some land, but he says hardly anyone in South America did. And that's true, because very few people owned all the land in South America, and they owned it, they got a hold of it, they captured it by use of force. They didn't really own it, right? They captured it. They took it. And of course, the evolution of finance, the development of financial industry is all dependent, which makes it possible then to industrialize, makes it possible to then have entrepreneurs and have businessmen and everything like that, is a consequence of a respect for property rights. But again, the real question is, where did property rights come from? How did property rights arrive at? And are property rights really a subcategory of a broader concept? And that broader concept is the concept of individual rights. The broader concept is the concept of the right to life, the right to your life. And this is, I think, the killer app that comes out of reason as the operating system. We'll see if Greg approves of this. I don't know. Right? If the operating system is reason, the killer app that makes all other apps possible, right? The killer app that makes all other apps possible, including the scientific revolution, which we'll get to, is individualism. Is the idea that the individual matters. It matters politically, and this is the idea of individual rights. Matters as an end in itself. And property rights cannot be understood without first saying your life matters and you need property in order to live, and therefore, yes, you have a right to your property. And it cannot be taken from you by force, just like your life cannot be taken from you by force. You should be free, free of coercion. That is the fundamental. Property rights are an important application of this. Maybe the most crucial application of this from a wealth perspective, from a, you know, economic success perspective. But it is essentially the idea of individual rights. So the killer app coming out of reason is individualism. And you know, this is my, I mean, a simple way to think about the relationship between reason and individualism. Reason is our basic means of survival. And each one of us as a human being has the capacity to reason. In other words, has the capacity to know the world, has the capacity, therefore, to choose the values that are necessary for his own survival or for his own thriving, for his own living as a human being. If each one of us has that capacity, then that kind of disconnects us from dependency on the philosopher king or the benevolent dictator or the pope or the authoritarian who tells us this is how you must live. And the individual goes, why? Because reason is the faculty of an individual. It's not a group thing. And you don't need any, you need to know how to use it, right? But you don't need any special knowledge. You don't need it to be a mystic, to commune with some spirit in order to be able to use the operating system. Everybody can do it. Every individual can do it. And only individuals can do it. And you can see how this has to lead to the idea that it's the individual that matters. It's the individual who thinks. Thinking is what makes life possible. Thinking is what makes progress possible. Thinking is what makes everything else possible. Values possible. And only individuals think. Therefore, it must be the individual. So individualism is my second kind of mega app, operating system, whatever you want to call it. Reason individualism are really what drive every other app, every other app, everything else. The success of the West is really a product of those two. And if you go back and you can see the fragmentation, the competition allowed reason and individualism to manifest themselves politically and in the scientific revolution and in writings and in art and in every other aspect of human life. Would Western civilization be in Western civilization without Renaissance art and without the art coming out of the Renaissance? You can't separate it. This is why having six apps is wrong. You need to find the fundamentals. And of course, you can see that flowering of individualism even in the Renaissance and the arts. You can see Michelangelo's David, or even in the Pietà, a Pietà, which is a sculpture of religious significance, Mary holding Jesus who's dead. But in Michelangelo's Pietà, Mary is a woman, a particular individual, a mother more than anything else, not a religious figure, but a mother. And Jesus is the son, not of God, but Mary's son. And she's holding her son, mourning his death. And he's not just a Bromite son. He's not just any son. He's not the son of God, you know. He is a Greek youth. He is an individual with individual features and beauty. You can see individualism right there. Michelangelo treating his subject as individuals, not as bromides. And of course, this is Greece. And of course, that individualism gets codified, if you will, into political philosophy by John Locke and by his predecessors, Pufendorf and others in the Netherlands, even before, in Spinoza. These individualistic ideas are entering into philosophy during this period, in the 17th century and the 18th century. And they are what ultimately drives everything else. It's philosophy, but it's a philosophy of reason. It's a philosophy of individualism. None of the philosophers are consistent. None of the philosophers get it completely right. None of the philosophers fully understand the implication of what they're doing, what it fully means. And all of them try to latch on to a little bit of religion or a little bit of mysticism in one form or another, a little bit of collectivism. But this is what matters. This is what matters, bringing reason individualism into the mainstream of thought in the 17th, but really in the 18th century. The fifth app is a manifestation of reason, but also of individualism. Modern medicine. And I find it interesting that he chooses this. I can understand it because, you know, if one of the standards by which human well-being has improved dramatically, its life expectancy, which has doubled and doubled, and it's the quality of life and the fact that we don't die of all these diseases, it's child mortality, it's all these things. And he says modern medicine has done all this. But again, modern medicine is just a manifestation of the scientific revolution. And it's a manifestation of reason. But it's more than that. It's the application of science to a specific individual's human life, not just understanding the physical world. Now suddenly we care about the well-being of an individual. An individual is sick. An individual needs to be cured. When you think about just masses of people, when you think about mobs, when you think about groups, when you think about collectives, healthcare doesn't really matter. That's why collectivism by necessity is going to generate everywhere in the world socialized medicine, because it doesn't matter. Like, and you can see this in Europe. The fact that people stand in line and die before they ever get diagnosed, never mind before they get treated, nobody cares. They don't really care. It's just part of life. That's just because they don't care about the individual anymore. Healthcare system in France is the best in the world for France, for the French. By some aggregate statistic, you measure it somehow by cost versus whatever. People die, but you shouldn't die if they had a decent healthcare system. But that doesn't matter. We've come up with some collectivistic, socialistic measures of success that the United Nations publishes. And by those standards, France has the best healthcare system in the world. Not for any particular individual, but for the group as a whole. You don't get modern medicine. You don't get the concern for the individual. You don't get concern for curing diseases that inflict individuals until you get a concern, a love, a care for the individual. So modern medicine is really the scientific revolution plus individualism, which is really reason plus individualism. Those effort, that cognition, that thinking went to making the lives of individuals better. Okay. His fifth is a complete manifestation of individualism. This is the consumer society. He says the consumer society is what you need for the Industrial Revolution to have a point. You need people to want to wear tons of clothes. You need people to want to. And he's right. It's not obvious that people want this stuff. It's not just human nature to want it. The primary here is that people want values, that people want to live, that people want to improve their lives, that people want to enjoy themselves, that people want, in the words of the Declaration of Independence, to pursue their happiness. But that's not just obvious. That's not just instinct in some way. That's an attitude that comes from ideas. Again, if you're part of a mob, if you're part of the group, if your life is meaningless, if you're taught to sacrifice to everybody and everything, if monks are not consumers, nuns are not good consumers because they've given their life to God. It's only when the individual gives his life to himself, it's only when the individual acknowledges the world in which he lives that he becomes a consumer. He wants to look nice. He wants to have nice things. He wants to improve his lot in life. He wants to live in a nice environment. He wants to eat good food. A consumer society is a product of individuals caring about themselves. It's a product of individuals knowing that they can take care of themselves. If I tell you, you can't take care of yourself. The stuff you buy is going to be bad for you. It's going to hurt you. It's going to deprive you. It's going to make you. You need somebody to tell you what to buy. If I can convince you of that, then why would you be interested? And you lose interest in consumer society. Part of consumer society is a product of the idea that every one of us can choose his own values and be competent at it. Not flawless at it, but competent at it. Whoops. So again, it's individualism, freedom. We'll get, there's the other killer app. One operating system, two killer apps. And finally, what he identifies as the work ethic, which was identified as Max Weber as the Protestant work ethic. Now, that's complete nonsense. We know that the Protestant, that people were caught all over the world, Protestants are not, when they value their own lives, when they are free to do so, when they are guided by their own minds and are not just automatons in some collectivistic machine. Indeed, today the highest work ethic in the world is in Asia, in places like Korea, South Korea, right? It's not among Protestants. So all of these can be integrated around these three. And all are consequence in the end of one, and that is reason. So reason, individualism, freedom, that is ultimately what makes the world prosper. That explains divergence. China, if you read Chinese philosophy, and I'm not an expert on Chinese philosophy, but the little I've read of Chinese philosophy, there's no concept of reason. There's no Aristotle in Chinese philosophy. They talk a lot about ethics and morality, and it deals a lot with relationships between hierarchies and people and everything. But there's no concept of science in the sense of, because there's no concept of reason. There's no epistemology in Chinese philosophy. No, nothing that goes beyond the mystical. So they can discover something here. They can discover something there. They almost by accident or some work of some genius. But there's no method. There's no system. They cannot have a scientific revolution. Confucius is okay in some aspects of human dealings with one another, but he has no epistemology. So they cannot have a scientific revolution. And because there's no idea of reason, there's no idea of it being a faculty of the individual. And as a consequence, there's no individualism. And what happens in the 20th century is basically that the Chinese and the people in the East have embraced, at least to some extent, the operating system of the West. They've embraced reason. They've embraced individualism. They've embraced freedom, at least to some extent. You cannot explain. And here I mean political freedom, but not democracy, because democracy is not necessarily political freedom. Indeed, what we're seeing is the disappearance of political freedom in the West in the name of democracy. In the name of democracy. Democracy is majority rule. Majority rule is not freedom. Individual rights, the protection of individual rights, the respect for individual rights, that's freedom. And to the extent that you have that in a political system, to that extent it is free. And to the extent that the country like China recognizes the importance of reason, recognizes the significance of science, respects individuals, not so much as a government, but as a society. If you go to China and you look at people today, in the streets of Shanghai, they dress differently, they act differently, they express their individualism. They're distinct people, and particularly as a rejection of the kind of communism, everybody looks the same, or old Chinese feudalism, everybody looked the same and everybody was in their place. The Chinese today are not in their place. They're in the streets, they're yelling, they're screaming, they're working, they're having a good time, they're enjoying themselves, they're pursuing happiness. At least that's my experiences of China, of the Chinese people of China. They're out there living. They might not have it right. They might not have their values right. But fundamentally, it's about themselves. So they got the individualism down, and they have some freedom, not as much as they should. None of us has as much as we should, but they have some freedom. All right. Let's see. We had a very early on. The super chat. The first super chat question I got is I can't reach in the chat. So if somebody wants to re-ask it, go ahead and do that. But I'll take super chat questions now. Deirdre McCloskey, who's an economist, her books are hard to read. Incredible information, incredible amounts of knowledge, and they're really fascinating. But they're hard to read. But she comes close. She identifies that it's ideas, but she can't identify reason, individualism. Political freedom she gets, but reason, individualism. And particularly reason, because she's religious. She views religion as having an important role in Western civilization. And she's an altruist. She can't fully embrace individualism. And she has to kind of go through a whole convoluted thing like Adam Smith does in A Wealth of Nations and in his theory of moral sentiments in order to kind of square his altruism, his Christian altruism, with the individualism of the marketplace. And she has the same problem, I think. Right. But fundamentally, everybody, all of these people get that something's different. They get at the less abstract level what those things are, property rights, you know, work ethic, but they don't get why do people work hard? Why do people work hard? They say because they've got the incentives, but it's because they care about their lives. They work hard because of the value to themselves that work represents, not just a monetary benefit, but also the fact that work is how we manifest, how we generate our self-esteem, where our self-esteem comes from. Work is challenging. It's where we can use our minds, where we can really explore ourselves. We can build, we can create, we can make stuff. Work is fun. And working hard is fun. It's purpose. In Ayn Rand's world, it's having a career is for most people your central purpose in life. And a central purpose is a necessary value to have in order to be successful in living, to be happy. So it's an essential part of individualism, the work ethic. It's this recognition of the value of my own life and to be productive and to make stuff. And the importance of being productive to your own life, to your own happiness, to your own well-being. So you know, this is at the end of the day, it really is all reason, individualism, and freedom, and in that order, one leads to the other. Okay. The beauty of it is the reason, individualism, freedom know no borders. They know no race. They know no ethnicity. They can be embraced by anybody. They can be embraced by individuals. This is one of the reasons why I'm pro-immigration. If somebody wants to embrace these values and they live in a horrible place in the middle of Africa, I want to be able to come and manifest those in the places that are free. It is a tragedy that somebody wants to live his own life for himself using his mind and is stuck in some horrific, horrible, evil society. What a tragedy. That's the ultimate tragedy. It's the reason I'm for immigration. I want to make it possible for that individual to be able to manifest those great values, to live the best life that he can live. And to do that, he has to get out of where he lives in. He has to go somewhere else. He has to immigrate. Now, I know not all immigrants are like that, but I base my positions on things like immigration not based on who the worst people are, but based on the best. I want somewhere for Ayn Rand to go. I want somebody from Leonard Peikoff to go. I want somewhere for, you know, John Locke and Newton and Aristotle and Galileo to go. Imagine if Galileo could have escaped the Catholics and gone somewhere where he could have been free to be a scientist. That's the standard. The standard is the best in mankind, not the worst. The worst we can deal with. I'm not worried by the worst. If I can attract the best, the worst are easy to deal with. People place way too much power, efficacy, significance to evil, to evil people, to evil ideas, and far too little to the good. If you could establish a free country and you would open its borders, yeah, with the screening, whatever, right, but basically open its borders, then you would attract the best. And yeah, some scumbags would come along as well. But you think that's a problem when you're attracting the best of mankind? You think they're a challenge when you're attracting the best of mankind? Really? That's America. That's America in the 19th century. A lot of scumbags came, but it didn't matter. It was a wash because the good guys came. Do you think that people should have an opt-out of things like minimum wage, etc.? Yeah, but I don't think minimum wage laws should exist. I don't think any of those kind of laws should exist. So having an opt-out would be nice, but nobody's going to give them an opt-out. Nobody's going to give them an opt-out. The whole idea of minimum wage laws is the legislation of a certain view of morality, the legislation of a certain view of the world by the elites. And they're not going to give you opt-outs to opt out of what they think is good for you, what they think is right, what they think is just. So the best way to do is not to have them at all. But there's no way to get around. He says, would it be a viable way around politicians' BS? Well, but politicians are the one who passed the laws. So they would never allow it. They would never allow opt-outs. Because exactly for the reasons you said, you didn't say it, but it's because you would opt out from their control. And they don't want you to opt out from their control. All right. Any other super chats? No, nobody wants to ask questions. An hour and 15 minutes of content. All right. Cool. Let's see. There was another super chat, but I'm sorry, I can't find it. So I'm scanning these just to see if it's here. I don't see you re-asking it, so I don't see it. So sorry about that. All right. That's it. Weston, now Ferguson, still 6 killer apps of prosperity. All good. Nothing that's wrong, just not the essentials. Not the essentials. Essentials are reason, individualism, capitalism, or reason, individualism, freedom. Right. Good. I will talk to you all in the next few days, I'm sure. Maybe tomorrow. But if not tomorrow, then certainly during the week, next week. I will see you all then. Have a great rest of the weekend. This is Yaron Brook. Oh, don't forget, share. I think there was a lot of good content here. Share it, please. Let people know. Share it. Subscribe to my YouTube channel. And support me on Patreon or subscribestar.com. And you can buy t-shirts and mugs with the Yaron Brook Show logo on them at, what is it, Zazzle, I think, .com. Just search Yaron Brook t-shirts, Yaron Brook Zazzle, and you can do it there. So I hope you buy lots of t-shirts with quotes. And if you have ideas for quotes, you have ideas for quotes that you'd like on your t-shirts, let me know on Facebook, on Twitter, somewhere, let me know. By email, and we will try to put up some additional shirts with some additional quotes. Have a great week, and I'm sure I'll talk to you before Christmas, but if not, Merry Christmas, everybody. Bye.